All right, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. Hope you guys are okay. Absolutely brilliant episode for you today. We have got an interview with a member of Oasis, which is always a good thing for the Oasis podcast. It is Andy Bell, a big hero of mine growing up, being from near Oxford. Ride were a massive band for me, and then Hurricane Number One were massive, and then when he joined Oasis, that was massive. So really, really pleased to be joined by Andy today. He's got a fantastic new album, which is called The View From Halfway Down. So make sure you go and buy it if you can, buy a physical release or at least listen to it, because it's absolutely brilliant. We get into talking about that, plus we get into a lot of the Oasis stuff as well, which was really, really great. You know, Andy doesn't need to talk about Oasis, he doesn't need to plug that, but you know, he was happy to, and it was really good to get that insight from him into how he first joined the band and going through song by song. So that was really, really good. It's been a huge week of Oasis news with the 25th anniversary of Morning Glory. There's been lots of new information come out, but I'm going to cover that on a separate episode. That deserves its own episode, so we will be back with that very shortly. And at the end of this, I don't do an outro, so just to say, do please follow me on Twitter at Oasis Podcast, on Facebook Oasis Podcast, Instagram Oasis Pod. Email me, oasispod@gmail.com, and do please support on Patreon if you can, patreon.com/oasispod, where you can get the episodes early and also exclusive episodes over there. So it's really good fun. All right, let's move on then, shall we? Here we go. Andy Bell on the Oasis Podcast. Yeah, so welcome to the Oasis podcast, Andy Bell. Thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome. It's good to be here.
Wonderful. So just obviously the main thing that's obviously big in your world right now is the new album is due out very shortly, which I've, you know, thankfully had an advanced copy of, and it sounds absolutely fantastic. Really enjoyed it. Why is this now, the time for you to do a solo album for the first time, when everything, obviously previously you've had Ride, you've had Glock, which was a great project in your like solo project effectively, but this is the first one that's Andy Bell.
Yeah. Kind of came out of doing a single that came out in 2019. So, I was asked by a friend of mine, Nat Cramp, who runs a label called Sonic Cathedral, if I wanted to put a couple of tracks on a single. And it was an idea that I'd been thinking about for quite a few years, to make a record myself. And I just kind of thought, well, let's just go for it now. Opportunities come up, let's just go for it. And so I put two tracks on a single. And then having done that, I'm the sort of person that likes to sort of continue down a path. So, sure. starting putting out solo records feels like you're obviously going to continue. So originally I was going to do another single that was going to come out this August. And because I was having trouble kind of compiling what tracks for the single, I was struggling a bit with it. And then lockdown happened, and had a bit more time to think about it, and ended up asking Nat if I could do it as an album instead, purely because I was not settling on the right tracks to put on a 12-inch, you know?
Oh, yeah. And are you the sort of person that, are you recording all the time? Have you always got little demos and things going all the time?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, cool. And so what was the, I noticed that Gem's on this one, or he recorded it at least. So was that, how was that working with Gem again?
It was great working with Gem, yeah. We live in the same neighbourhood, and I see him a lot, like in an everyday kind of sense. So he came to engineer it because I was just chatting to him. Just after David Bowie died, I was just chatting to him about wanting to do some music. And I asked him if I could do it at his studio, and he just said, yeah, you know, and that was simple as that.
Fantastic. And how was the old process of sort of putting it together? And was there a, because it's this album, I've really, really enjoyed it, by the way, and it's got a real definite vibe
Thank
to
you.
It. It's interesting because it's like each of the songs individually are very different, but then actually it does really work as an entire album. I don't quite know how you pulled that off, but what was the idea with this one? Were you sort of aiming for something? Because I think there's definitely elements of Glock, the electronic album you did, but then it's really, there's a lot of ride in there as well. So were you aiming for a specific thing, or was it just how you were feeling in sort of in this crazy sort of period we've had?
How I kind of channel things between either me or Glock or a ride track or whatever it is I mean, the ride ones are usually pretty obvious. Then the Glock stuff is all the stuff that's instrumental and more electronic. And then if I've got singing on it, then it kind of feels like it's more to do. If it's got singing on it and it's a bit more personal and a bit more kind of just me or folky or something, or a bit more retro-y or something, then it feels like ride won't want to do it or
right,
it doesn't suit ride. So then it ends up in a different pile. And that was where all this stuff was hanging out. Also, when I was thinking about what to put on this record, I didn't want it to be just packed full of short, punchy tunes, because I've been doing that for the last few years with Ride. You know, the last two Ride albums that have come out, they are really punchy. All the songs are really kind of concise, and you know, with a couple of exceptions. But basically, I wanted to do something where there wasn't so much emphasis on songwriting, more just like setting up a cool sound and letting it just hover in the air for a bit. Like songs like Indica, they don't really have much going on apart from just a cool set of instruments playing at once, you know. So I wanted to give space to the music.
Yeah, no, definitely. And Indica is an interesting one. Is that named after the Indica Gallery from the 60s? Nice, thought so. Yeah, that's cool. That's got an interesting like backwards vocal line in it as well. What is that? Is that from somewhere else in the album? Like,
yes, it is. It's repurposed Stone Roses style. Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. Stone Roses. It's your, yeah. Obviously, it's like your thing. But
they kind of own that. To me, they own that idea. You know.
Yeah, fair enough. I really liked the last track as well. Is that Wayland Road? Is that Headington?
Yes, it is.
Oh, fair enough.
Oh, you are Oxford, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, I'm just south of Oxford. I'm Didcot, south of Oxford. So,
I was born in Cardiff, Wales, but I don't remember Cardiff, and I don't remember being in Wales at all. I was about one. I was 18 months old when the three of us moved to Oxford.
Sure.
And so all I remember is Oxford, and I grew up from the age of 18 months up to about 10, living on Wayland Road.
Yeah.
And one of my first memories was the summer of 76, which you won't have any idea what I'm talking about, but that was a very hot summer, and there was a drought in the UK. And I do remember standing outside my house, looking at the street, and the air vibrating, you know, the air shimmering.
Wow.
Like a literal heat haze. And the smell of the tarmac melting. Can I remember that feeling and just being like red hot? So, I mean, in the album, I've kind of, it's a little bit like, it's that thing where you go back into your childhood and stuff. That song has got lyrics and they're all about Oxford, but I never quite was happy with it, how it turned out. So I listened to an instrumental at some point and just thought, this actually feels more like what I was going for without the words on it.
No, well,
it's all about cycling up Shot Over Hill and sort of going to the quarry wreck. Like Headington Quarry is very much where I used to go and play as a kid. And there was a little part with a roundabout, and there was a part with a really super long slide. And I just like cycled down there with my mates from, you know, school time till dark every day.
But no, so that's super cool. So really good luck with the album. Yeah, I mean, what's the plan for it? I suppose it's such a annoying situation right now, because I suppose typically you'd be looking at like gigs and promo stuff, but obviously it's all on
this
hold.
This is what
right
everyone
now.
assumes, like that I had a plan that's now been cancelled, and you know, oh, poor Andy, he can't tour his album. But there wasn't any plan. It was, as I said, it was going to be a single, and I wasn't planning to do gigs. So, I mean, people might think that I've had lots of stuff cancelled for this project, but I hate that word project. But yeah, the solo record hasn't got any gigs with it or anything. And okay. If I do, I mean, I might do some in the future, but they'll be further on down the line. I've got writer stuff to be getting on with now.
Fair enough. One of the cool things in lockdown that was really lovely was you doing little videos, especially of the Oasis songs. You know, it was great to see you do the other bits and pieces, and Hurricane as well. That was a big band for me in the as a teenager. But because I think you'd obviously, like, you know, Ride had become your big thing, and that had been your focus for a few years, and I hadn't really seen you talk much or do much anything related to Oasis. So to see these little videos on Instagram of you doing Thank You for the Good Times and Turn Up the Sun and stuff, it was massive. So, you know, I know in the just from the Oasis world, thank you for doing that, because that was great.
It was cool doing it. I mean, I was just doing requests, really. It was just a way of getting through lockdown. Right. Yeah, lockdown was one of those things we all went through together, wasn't it? And for me, it was the same as for most people, like homeschooling young kids, trying to work from home, trying to manage everything all at once. And I don't know, and just sitting in the house all the time and not seeing people and wondering what the hell was going on in the world, you know? So I started doing the requests on Instagram for my own mental health, really. It was great because I'd get all this instant feedback and loads of requests would come in, and, you know, there were so many requests for the Oasis tunes that I just couldn't not do them, you know?
Back on your time with Oasis now, because it's been, I was thinking about your career, it's funny, you've got kind of very clearly defined, you've got, like, you know, Ride was for like this period, and then Oasis was this period of like 10 years, then BDI was like 5 years, and then Ride was, it's interesting the way it's kind of chunked up. So as you've, you know, and you've had a big birthday recently, are you kind of looking back a bit at those times and sort of, you know, sort of thinking about that and recontextualizing it in your life, or do you tend to just move forward?
I don't know. I'm not like a multitasker, really, or I haven't been until now. So I just do one thing at a time generally. But now recently I've started doing many things all at once, just because I think I felt the clock ticking a bit, to be honest. I mentioned Bowie's passing, and that really was a bit of a catalyst for me to think, well, instead of just sitting around waiting for things to happen, just do some things, you know. So it's ended up with me putting out the Glock stuff and the my stuff, and just being a bit more proactive, getting tunes out there, because I don't know, I don't want to just die one day with a load of stuff that's not been heard, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, that's great. Do you mind if we jump into the Oasis stuff a little bit?
No, go ahead.
One of the things that would be great to just get a bit of a bit further detail on was the whole, like, what happened with leaving Hurricane, and that kind of fell, you know, sort of ended. And then there was this period where you were almost joined Gay Dad, and then, like, the Oasis thing happened. And I've just read it, like, basically two sentences, like, that's how it worked. But how did that work? Like, how far down the line were you with Gay Dad? And then was it literally like you get a phone call? And, like, can you just tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So Ride finished. I put together Hurricane number one. And, I mean, you can hear in Hurricane, in the records, one of the main influences is definitely Oasis in the first place. You wanted to reach her, but now you're the man. You'll never see her.
of an illusion, and you're falling. Looks like dancing. I hear you calling. It's alright, but it's just an illusion.
First album came out really well, second one not so much, and we didn't exactly set the world alight. So by the end of the 90s, I was pretty much burned out. I'd done like four Ride albums, we'd broken up, I'd done two Hurricane albums, and I'd made two albums with Ida as well, my first wife. And I basically had it. I just stopped enjoying it, stopped writing songs, lost interest. So I had a kid as well. So we had a kid, young kid, and we ended up moving to Sweden. And so start of 99, I'm living in Stockholm, Sweden, and I've given my main guitar to my guitar tech, Scotty. And basically, I quit music in my head anyway. And it's the only time in my life when I felt that way. So it was a very quiet year, 99. I was at home with our daughter, and my wife, Ida, was working. I didn't speak Swedish, so I just sat around the place. And occasionally someone that I knew would come through town during a gig. And one of these people was Cliff Jones, who was a journalist who was writing for Guitar Magazine, or a Guitar Magazine. And he'd interviewed me early days with Ride about guitars, and we'd stayed in touch. And he just called me and said, oh, I've got a band now. It's called Gay Dad. It's coming through town, you know, fancy coming out for a beer. And so I went to see the gig, and then that was all good. About a week later or 2 weeks later, he calls me and says, we need a guitarist, can't do, I don't know, it's like some German dates or something, some like five gigs in Germany coming up in a month or two's time. Our guitarist can't make it. Could you do it? And I sort of thought about it and just thought, well, I guess that sounds all right. I'll just do a few gigs with them. And so Cliff went back to the UK, or he was in the UK. We went to the papers and said, Andy Bell's joining Gay Dad. And this alerted Oasis to the fact that I was knocking about. So I think, you know, without, I don't know whether they would have ever called me without that happening, but I never played or so much as rehearsed with Gay Dad at all. It never happened. Right. It was just something that was being talked about. He got a little bit giddy and announced it as me joining the band. But before any of that happened, I ended up getting a call from Oasis and kind of basically joining them.
Fair enough.
Cliff had to sort of swallow it. I had to sort of phone him and say, look, I can't do this gig. I'm really sorry. And I can't tell you why either. But then when the news came out, eventually, he was really cool about it. So, I mean, nice one to Cliff. He was cool about that.
Fair enough. No, it's interesting because the story is that they read it, I think, in Melody Maker, like, Andy Bell's joining Gay Dad. We should get him in our band. Like, and that was, because I remember reading it at the time. Obviously, I was reading the music papers religiously at the time. And that was like, wow, that's a big signing for Gay Dad. It was like a football thing. You know what I mean? Like, wow, that's a massive signing. Andy Bell have got, Gay Dad's got Andy Bell. Because Gay Dad were really good. I really liked their first album. But still, like, you know, you're Andy Bell. And so it was like, wow, that's a hell of a signing for them.
And I mean, then, I was completely out of the loop. I didn't know I was joining a band that was massive. I just thought I was helping a mate out.
Oh, really? Okay.
I was a little bit like, well, why have you gone to the papers with that? I'm just, you know, this is just, I was hoping to get it under the radar, really.
Right. Okay. Whereas Cliff, maybe is his journalist background, was like, yeah, great. Oh, dear. No. But then, so the call comes from Oasis. So obviously you'd known the guys being on the label. And I know you'd sort of, I've heard you talk before about, you know, sort of being involved quite early on and hearing the early versions of Live Forever and stuff. So were you close with them from back then, or was it more just like a passing thing?
Well, close is a funny way. I mean, I'd met him a few times early on and really got on with him. And it all goes back to, I mean, really like quite early days, like Ride had done two albums, Nowhere, Going Blank Again. And we were working on a third one when I heard the Oasis demo. That's a whole story if you want to hear it. I was in Hollywood with Mark Gardner, because we'd gone out to kind of hang out and work on songs with our producer that we were going to work with, George Tchoukalis. So we were staying, and Alan McGee was out with us. We were staying at the Mondrian Hotel in LA on Sunset Strip. And We were spending days hanging out with George Jakoulias, who was living in Rick Rubin's house in the hills. And right across the way from there, in the Chateau Marmont, Primal Scream happened to be in town. So we had this a week or two where all of us were in town together and we were just hanging out. And somewhere during that week, Alan pulled out the cassette of this new band Oasis and put it on in the car. We were driving up to, I mean, we'd been on a bit of a mad one at Chateau Marmont the previous night and had a kind of all-nighter with the Scream lot. And this is the next day and we're heading up to a party in the hills somewhere. Nobody that I knew, nobody that anyone knew, but we just heard there was a party going on in a lovely, you know, like, you know, the houses on Selling Sunset? Someone's fancy pad. And on the way up there, Alan's played me this cassette. I'm pretty sure it had Married With Children was the version. I think it was like when I heard it on the album, I was like, oh, that's that version. You know, mm-hmm. I think it was that version. Also, I remember hearing Bring It On Down was on that cassette. And my reaction was, fucking hell, this is like the Jesus and Mary Chain meets the Kinks or something. It's so distorted and punky, but also so like 60s and classic.
Yeah.
So I loved it. Over the next few months, you know, Alan kept getting more and more of these demos. And as you mentioned, I heard a Live Forever demo that was the one with the guitar intro at the beginning instead of the drums. And I caned that cassette so much that when I heard the drum one, I was like, oh man, they changed it. But like early days, I mean, I think it might have been the first time they came to the office, I happened to be there. I was just hanging out one afternoon, as you did in the Creation Office. It was very much a hangout place. You'd pop in if you were in town, and Alan and, you know, Tim Abbott and them that would be down in the basement just sort of playing records. And the place was coated, all the walls were coated in pictures from magazines and stuff. It was just like a student room, basically. Music always playing, always stuff going on. So I was in the office one day and Alan came in with the whole of Oasis with him, like a vibey little gang who were just looking around at everything, kind of going, oh, wow, it's all this. Then another day, around that time, I remember going to see Neil Young at Finsbury Park and they were all there. And I chatted to them that day. I chatted to him at the Neil Young gig. I was chatting to Liam. I remember a couple of things he said. He was talking about OX4, the ride song OX4. He said, our kid's got that OX4 on his answer phone. I don't know if he meant Noel or Paul, but one of them apparently had that tune on his answer phone. And then he asked me if I had any Dennis. I was like, what? Dennis? Dennis Law, draw, you know. I pointed him at Tim Abbott and then, you know, then the day carried on.
That's not what we call it in Headington. No.
I was already a massive fan by that point anyway. So I remember, you know, I would have been saying to them, oh, I love your band and everything. They were coming out to London quite a lot. And I'd see them in the office, see them in the pub and gigs and stuff, and they were just so full of energy when you saw them, like really, like, just, I don't know, up for life, basically.
Yeah.
I think Oasis were the band that Creation had been waiting for.
Right.
Like, up until then, it had been Primal Scream were the biggest band, but Primal Scream were always a little bit kind of off-center. They weren't, like, route one, like, heading for the charts. It was like, if Primal Scream did a tune that was chart-friendly, like, Loaded,
yeah,
then it was sort of a hit, but then they'd do a lot of stuff that was a bit more weirder.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, the biggest bands before that had been, I mean, just all really left field kind of indie stuff, like Jesus and Mary Chain, House of Love, The Valentines, and that's a lot. And everyone had been circling around, you know, you'd be trying to get in the charts, but you would be like thinking, oh, we're not really trying to get in the top 40, but you would be trying to get in the top 40. But
right.
it wasn't cool to be seen. To be getting, yeah, exactly.
Right,
so
right.
They come along, bust all the doors open and go, we want to be number one. And then they became number one. Because everything was just perfect. The timing was perfect. Like they arrived on the scene super ready. Like, and then the label was ready and the world was ready. Everything was ready. Like, I mean, I saw them do a gig at Islington Powerhouse, right? Which would have been the end of 93, I think.
Yeah, that's their first London gig. People forget about that one because it was the Water Rats. No, people think of the Water Rats as, but actually, yeah, they did do that Powerhouse one before. So you were there. Oh, cool.
Yeah, I was there. It was sort of a showcase, I think, for Sony. But it wasn't like super publicized. It was kind of, they were starting to make a name for themselves, but it hadn't quite happened yet. So I think they were trying to get a gig in for everyone who was going to be working on it to come and see them. Before it happened, before we got too busy.
Right.
But like, the point I wanted to make about that gig was, I mean, I'm in the audience watching the stage. The Powerhouse is a small venue, but I saw the same set with the same attitude, the same quality, same stage presence and charisma, the same everything and the same sound as basically Main Road. Like, it was unbelievably together. Like, I don't mean together in a professional way, I mean together as in it was fucking real. It was the authentic article in front of you, and you're like, I mean, I've been to so many gigs and seen so many bands, and you go, that was a great gig, but in the back of your head there's always something you come away thinking, well, it's great, but you know, they haven't got that many tunes, or it was good second half, or they let it down with this, or you talked too much, or something was, or it sounded shit. But there was none of that with Oasis. It was absolutely phenomenal. Or it was like, I don't know. It's something that I remember still, the feeling of that.
And was there a rivalry there? Were you like, shit, like, you know, we're supposed to be like the big band on Creation with, and now these boys are coming and taking our kind of, you know, our place, or it just sounds like you would have just loved it. And I've seen a picture of you in the mid 90s wearing Oasis t-shirt as well. So you were obviously like, just, yeah, look, I just love this band. Yeah.
I think maybe if they'd have come out maybe a year earlier or 2 years earlier, there might have been some kind of feeling like that. But by the time this was happening, Ride was past, we were past our peak. We'd done the second album and we'd had a top 10 single. But then the next single had gone lower and we'd stumbled a little bit trying to do a third album. So all this I'm talking to you about now.
Yeah.
You know, the first time I heard the cassette, we were writing for the third album. The gig at the Powerhouse, we're still trying to make our third album. I remember saying to either Liam or Noel after the Powerhouse, oh, we're going to be going on tour soon. You know, it'd be great to have you come and support us. And them going, yeah, cool. Sort of, you know, sounds all right. But then obviously about 2 months later, they were bigger than us. You know, literally, it was so quick. I was feeling that Ride was losing our way a little bit, because the album we were trying to make, our third album, had none of that energy of Oasis. It had a West Coast American 70s rock vibe, which is all right, which is cool. But one thing Ride did a lot was we bit off more than we could chew musically. We kind of swung wildly between sounds. And like the first album is pretty much us playing to our strengths. Second Ride album is more adventurous and really works because it's like it's a lot of more influences are coming in. And we're like, we've got this we can do anything sort of feeling that's on Go and Blank again. It just feels like it's all working. We can do a little bit of a Nick Drake type song. We can incorporate some elements from Massive Attack, Unfinished Sympathy into the backing track of a song, and it still feels like Ride. We can do this, we can do that. We can try things, and you've still got Leave More Behind as like a real, you know, like this is a straightforward Ride tune that really just kicks, you know. But on the next record after that, we had decided to become something that we just shouldn't have ever done. We decided to sort of become Led Zeppelin,
right?
With the, you know, we might have had the guitars, we might have had the drums, but we certainly did not have the vocals to do like a 70s rock album or anything like that. I mean, it was always going to become a little bit weak if we weren't doing, and we were sort of like trying to not do the same we saw them as sort of tricks we'd done before. So I think, you know, long story short, I think musically we were getting lost, and the Oasis stuff was a massive wake-up call for me. I just felt like, you know, everything that happened after that for me musically was kind of playing catch up with that energy. So the Third Ride album happened, and it felt like a little bit of a out of place record by the time it came out. And then the fourth one was really just trying to claw something back, because the third one never got to tour the world. So we were back in the UK with nothing to do. And the band was obviously having problems. We weren't really getting on as well. But I had the bright idea of going straight back in the studio to make a record really quick and try and capture some of that energy. So Tarantula was sort of a reaction in that direction. But during the making of that album, the band broke up. So it was basically a doomed kind of attempt.
Oh, well, the only other thing I was going to say about joining, obviously you've got the fact that it was on bass, whereas obviously you'd always been this guitar player and this like heralded guitar player. And then to join Oasis, it was almost like Gem had kind of got in first and kind of nicked guitar. And then so the option was bass. But I saw you, I think you tweeted something out, I think in a reply to someone saying you would have played the triangle to join Oasis or something like that, which I thought was a really lovely thing to say.
But I'm a pretty mean triangle player, you know.
Oh, I bet you are. But was it that? Was it just like, that'll be an interesting challenge? Or did you sort of think, we'll see how it goes?
But there was learning to do on a bass. You know what I mean? Like, didn't bother me at all. It was actually quite good. I didn't have really any idea how to play one. I just knew that I knew the strings were the same notes. So I was... if the song was in, had certain chords, I knew how to play those notes. Like, so if the song goes A, D, G, I know where those notes are on a bass, right. So I can busk along. And I managed to do enough in the audition that I was in. And then I went away and absolutely became a bass player in about 2 months. I did not want to mess this up. I just took a massive amount of pride in nailing it, you know, like nailing it to a level where, you know, a force 10 gale could be blowing and I'd still be playing those same bass lines, playing them right. So a big element of that was Alan White was extremely patient with me, and he was such a cool guy to be learning with, because he'd come in early with me and we'd kind of just practice together. And my whole ethos as a bass player was to just get in with the kick drum, with the drums, and just try and just be that heartbeat for the band. You know, you just got to be in there as a little rhythm section. And we were great. We were really, really great. I used to stand so close to Whitey on stage that I went deaf in one ear from the cymbals. but it was all about getting to the heart of the sound and keeping that heart pumping, you know?
Yeah. Was it interesting when you were, because obviously a lot of the Oasis bass lines are quite straightforward. You know, there's a lot of root notes and quite simple.
No, not at all. They're not at all simple. No. They weren't to me anyway. I had a lot of learning to do. I had a lot to work out, and you know, just the idea of taking on board a whole catalogue at once.
Mm.
A lot of songs that have got similar tempos, but they've got different bass lines. So you know, Supersonic does not feel like Columbia. They've all got something about them, and whatever that thing is really well built. You know, it's not like a case of you can turn up and play. Like, I mean, obviously in the audition, I did sort of turn up and play just the root notes and try and get by that way, but it ain't like that. It's every song's got its own feel on the bass for sure.
Oh, that's cool. And I like the fact that it's funny with the, when the obviously the lineup with yourself and Gem kind of came together, it was, you know, a lot of things were quite similar to how the guys had played it previously. But then you had things like the Cigarettes and Alcohol that had the Whole Lot of Love outro. That was really cool. Can you remember who sort of came up with that as an idea and where that kind of came from?
Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of something that happened in rehearsal. I guess Noel would have played the riff and we would have joined in and then decided to keep it. So, I mean, I think you'd probably say that was like a call that Noel made about that kind of thing. So we might have a jam and then he might say, oh, let's kind of work that bit into it or something.
And then, yeah, and so you come in sort of in this sort of tricky period, and then you're touring an album that you didn't play on effectively. And then, but then when you come to actually starting to write songs for them as well. So the first song you write for them is on Healing Chemistry, which is A Quick Peep, which is a really cool little instrumental piece. I mean, were you thinking at that point, you know, were there other songs that you wanted to go on the album but you had to fight for, or was that like the main thing that you were sort of aiming to put on the album at that point?
Well, that was all up to them, you know. I didn't have any say on what went on, but I think A Quick Peep and Thank You for the Good Times were part of the same little bunch. Yeah,
right.
And one of them was on a B-side, one of them was on the album.
Fair enough. And so is it, I sort of imagine
it. I think that was the same album. It might have been the next album, but Quick Peep was the first one that came out.
Yeah. And Thank You for the Good Times was a B-side later, but yeah, same period. But I almost imagine it like the Beatles, you know, like George Harrison kind of coming with these songs, or was it more just like, okay, well, look, that's my songs and it's kind of over to you guys to sort of figure it out.
Well, A Quick Peep was initially called Back Lounge Blues. We're never going to be called that in the end. That's just a silly title for it. But because I came up with it in the back lounge of the tour bus, and it was because we were all into Fleetwood Mac at the time, Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac. And so the way I thought about it was, it is a quick peep. It's a little jam that might do something a bit like the Swamp Song, you know, like an in-between bit. So, and I think that was where it was intended to fit, just like in between two bigger tunes, because Oasis have a lot of big tunes. So,
yeah, have a little interlude kind of thing. That makes a lot of sense. Talking about Fleetwood Mac, Peter Green, Fleetwood Mac, you know, I was talking to Matt Dayton recently. He sort of said about coming on the tour when he stood in for Noel for that period, and that straight away you guys were like, listen to loads of Fleetwood Mac, and you know, in that period, and he was like, oh, I love Fleetwood, that's exactly my period. And so that was sort of something that you vibed over straight away. And also he mentioned about Syd Barrett, that the two of you would be listening to quite a lot of Syd Barrett on the tour bus.
Yeah, I mean, listen to a lot of music every night, and you know, there's nothing else to do, so you just like having a drink, listening to great music, and sharing, you know, like sharing stuff that people might not have heard, and yeah, vibing basically.
No, that's cool. What about Thank You for the Good Times then? I mean, that's a really great tune. I think that's one that over the years, people do go back to, and you see it on people's like top 10 Oasis songs and things like that. Definitely. You definitely see that. There's Thank You for the Good Times and Keep the Dream Alive, especially that, you know, these, because I suppose at the time, like, it's just the B-sides come out and that's it, they come and go. But then now it's Spotify world, you know, and so people are coming back to it. But now I see loads of people talk about Thank You for the Good Time. I mean, Turn Up the Sun, obviously, was a big one for the fact it was on the album. But, yeah, Thank You for the Good Times and Keep the Dream Alive. Definitely definitely get that.
The one that I always think about, it's like a B-side classic, is Let's All Make Believe. I love that thing. But Thank You for the Good Times anyway is like, it's kind of, I've arrived in this situation and it's just me saying thank you really to them. It's like a toast to the band, the past members, the present members, the future members, just saying, you know, I'm having a great time here. It's great, isn't it, sort of thing.
That's fantastic. I didn't know it was about the band. That's great. And it's got a real sort of Faces feel to it as well, especially when you get that like chunking guitar in the chorus. Like, was that sort of a Faces kind of influence at that point?
I like the Faces, so maybe. Yeah, I mean, that one more than any other one is me occupying the Oasis sound.
Yeah.
Although when I do it, it kind of feels a bit more like a teenage fan club or something, but that was, it was written as an Oasis song.
Yeah.
Probably the only one that was out of all of them.
Yeah. That you were specifically thinking, right, I'm going to write an Oasis song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you're writing those songs, are you sort of imagining, okay, how Liam, when you think kind of singing it to yourself, are you kind of doing it like, come on, turn up the sun? Are you kind of doing like a Liam impression in your head almost how it will sound?
No, generally I'd be writing pretty freely, as I always do. Every so often I'd come up with an idea that felt like it might suit the band, and the first time I brought a song to them, it was Thank You for the Good Times, and that, because that was the way it was, the idea was very Oasis from the very beginning, and on that one I tried harder to make it even more Oasis. I wanted to make it feel like a real Oasis tune, because it was the first one I gave to them. But after that, I relaxed and let them all happen a bit more naturally.
Sure. Something like Turn Up the Sun has got such a cool like intro and outro, and then you've got like the sort of the primary kind of song in the middle. Was that always meant to be that way, or did you end up, was that like a stitching together a couple of different ideas thing?
No, that was always conceived that way. The difference was that when I did it in Sweden at home, it was like, it was really downbeat, and it was like a Lars demo, like a Lars B-side. One of those tracks like Over or Man, I'm Only Human or Who Knows, where the very lo-fi and sort of quiet and hushed and sort of, you know, like, I don't know if acoustic, but quiet anyway.
Mm.
And so I'd written a song and I really liked it, but I didn't know what it was going to do. And then I gave it to the guys. And then one day I turned up at rehearsal, and I turned up a bit later than everyone else, and they were playing it, and it was, they just gave it this huge rock and roll makeover, and it just blew my head off. So yeah, they made it what it became.
I mean, even the lyrics for something like that, like "I carry a madness," it's such an incredible kind of, you know, instant line, especially with Liam's voice. It's like, bang, it gets you.
So on the demo, the first line was "I carry a sadness," which fits that early version of the song. But in rehearsal, that got changed to "I carry a madness," which works so much better when you have Liam singing it. I think it was Liam's idea to change it, but I'm not totally sure. I think they came up with the change just before I arrived that day. Anyway, I loved it.
So that's made such a difference. It would be so different if it was "I carry a sadness," wouldn't it?
But that was the effect they had on the song, and it was, you know, it's like it makes it Oasis.
Yeah, definitely. That's really, really cool. When you're coming into the studio with this stuff, obviously live, you know, you are on the bass, and it's interesting that, you know, some bands will swap instruments, won't they? Some bands will, like, you know, I'm going to go on the bass for a bit, I'll double up on guitar for a bit. With Oasis, it was never the case. It was like, look, we play our five instruments that we bring on to, well, obviously Liam's singing, but you don't do that. Was there ever any discussion that you might want to kind of, you know, oh, maybe I can double up on acoustic guitar on this one or anything else? Or was it like, no, that's not how we do it?
I played a bit of guitar on some of my own ones and a little bit of acoustic on a tune or two, but yeah, basically it was mainly that way.
No, fair enough. And then when you come to, like, so Keep the Dream Alive was another one, and once again, this is like definitely one that gets heralded, you know, as another. It's because it's got such a lovely message to it as well, I think. Keep the Dream Alive, I mean, what was the thinking behind that one?
Thinking about Keep the Dream Alive reminds me of the recording sessions at Capitol Studios in Hollywood with Dave Sardy. It's a great recording. Everyone's on top form on this tune. It's my favourite bit of Zach drumming, for example, on any Oasis tune on this one. I was going through a time when everything in my personal life wasn't totally perfect, but it's about getting through those times by thinking about who you are and why you think you're on the planet, and yeah, keeping the dream alive,
you know.
I'm no stranger to this place where we
When you bring that, like an example, when you're bringing that into the studio, and then you're sort of, or were you demoing these first, and you sort of sending off demos to, like, Noel and thing, or like sending off demos, guys, have a think about this, or was it more you come to the studio and say, you know, what do you think of this tune?
I think I used to always send demos across. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I wasn't quite in London yet. I was in Sweden through till 06, and then moved over to London. At the end of 06, I moved to London.
Sure. With the demos, is there a lot? I mean, it's frustrating. One of the things I've talked about quite a bit on the podcast is that it's difficult. We know that there's tons and tons of stuff out there that's just not been released. Like, you know, there was a bunch of GEMS demos from sort of 2005 that got leaked sort of a couple of years ago, and sort of some guys bought them and put them up on a forum. But, you know, we know there's tons of stuff, and especially the 2000s years, because they haven't really done any kind of reissues, any sort of, you know, deluxe versions with, you know, there must be tons of stuff out there. I mean, is that something that you'd be interested to have deluxe issues of the albums that you played on go out with all the sort of the behind the scenes stuff?
I tend to think that the album is the album, and that's the most important thing. I'm sure there are people that would love to hear every outtake.
I don't know.
No, well, I suppose just as a like a, you know, you've got like Dylan that just puts out everything, you know, every, all the basement tapes, everything you've gone. It's just as a kind of an Oasis kind of geek and completionist, you're like, we know there's this stuff, you know, and it would just, it's frustrating. It would just be great to hear it all. But anyway, hopefully maybe a, maybe 20th or 25th of Heathen Chemistry and Don't Believe the Truth and stuff, it will come out. But
I feel that way about the Beatles, you know, I want to hear everything they did.
Yeah. Yeah. But you don't feel that way about Oasis?
Well, it's different if you're in the band, I guess.
Maybe. All right. And then the last one you did for the last album was The Nature of Reality, which has got a really cool vibe to it. It's got this sort of like off-kilter kind of huge sort of drum sound to it as well. Where did that come from?
So after 8 years of living in Sweden, I finally moved to London at the end of 2006. And that was because my first marriage ended. This song comes from that period. And I went a little bit intense for a while. This is a pretty strange thing, strange lyric to put in a song. But it was where I was at the time. It was all like, there's nothing else in life but what you can prove scientifically. Nothing else exists, no religion, nothing beyond what we can see with our eyes and all that kind of thing. My parents are really religious, so that was a big deal for me to write that. Like, I wasn't a Christian, but I hadn't ever written anything like anti-religion. So I had to tell my dad, you know, I've written this song, you're gonna hate it. I told him all about the lyrics and he was like, well, why do you think I'll hate it? My favourite tune in the world is Imagine. That's obviously another anti-religion song. So that was a really cool thing between me and my dad that happened out of that tune. Musically, it was influenced by the White Stripes. So on the demo, there was like one guitar, drums and vocals. And it was in like a pretty cool open tuning. So yeah, White Stripes.
With a little bit of Helter Skelter in it as the chord at the beginning. Because it's in a really cool...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good open tuning, that's in. And I've got to sit down and work out what that is because I'd love to be able to play that at will. But I've forgotten what the tuning was. But it's like a real... Is that a real Helter Skelter kind of... Charles Manson chord, like da, 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 da.
Speaking of how to play things, my best mate who I was in the band with, basically Step Into My World was the main song that inspired us to start a band. And like, that was like, that's our sound, right? So wow. You know, thank you for that. Or I think you're probably quite responsible for our friends and family being dragged to some pretty awful gigs, but it was that was kind of our sort of key thing. So thank you for that. But also my mate Joel, who was the guitarist, was like, when you did the little video Step Into My World, he was like, oh, he's played that wrong there. So I don't know,
I don't know how to play them. These tunes on the lockdown thing, I don't know how to play any of them, really. I'm just busking. And I didn't, you know, some of them have got real shapes to them. Like Keep the Dream Alive has chord shapes that are actually some of my favourite. You know, it was one of my favourite chord progressions, that, because it's got like four really good shapes, like Vapor Trail, nice and easy. Once you know where it is on the neck, it's like easy to play. But it's a lovely little set of shapes to play.
Yeah.
But like Step Into My World, I don't even know what key it's in. Every time I play that song, I've got to figure it out. so you get songs where they're tied to a chord shape. Other songs are just whatever. Almost Thank You for the Good Times, you could play it in any key. It's not really set as a certain, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, so there's certain songs that are just quite, yeah, you can just pick them up, can't you, in whatever key. Oh, that makes sense. And of the other guys' songs, I mean, when you were out playing live, which ones did you really enjoy playing from the on the live stuff?
Rock and Roll Star, Champagne Supernova, Bring It On Down. Yeah, I mean, I liked them all, man. Cigarettes and Alcohol. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's really cool.
My Generation was always a favourite.
I was going to ask about My Generation. I mean, that was when they, because that was a Radio 1 poll, right, to say what song were you going to cover? And my understanding is it was Country House or My Generation it came down to. When right. It came to My Generation, were you like, oh, shit, I've got to do, like, the most trickiest...
Threw me in a deep end, didn't I?
I know, it's like the hardest and the most famous bass solo in the world. How did you feel about that?
It was all right. It was like doing guitar solo.
It is really cool. I mean, like, the version you do is slightly different to Entwistle's version, but hey, it's excellent. It comes across really well.
That's because Entwistle is, like, the greatest bass player ever, and I'm just, like, some guy who plays guitar and sometimes plays bass, you know? Just my generation,
Andy, thanks so much for taking the time. As I say, I'm really, really looking forward to everyone else getting to hear this fantastic album. You know, it's so brilliantly put together. As I say, as I said earlier, like, it works really well as an album, but all the individual tracks as well, it's just something about them. And so really good luck with it.
All right, thanks very much. That's really appreciated.